This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. May is Maestro Month on Cadenza, and we'll chat with great conductors not born here, but leading some of the top orchestras in the U.S. And we'll begin with the Frenchman Louis Langres, who is in his fifth season as music director of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra, and his contract has been extended through 2020. All seems well in that great Ohio City. Maestro Langres took a very European side door path to the podium, working in many regional opera houses as repetiteur, assisting conductors at hand. No real formal training in conducting. Those positions ratcheted up to Bayreuth and l'Orchestre de Paris. He started leading opera companies like Glyndebourne and orchestras in Liège and Salzburg. And his U.S. conducting debut was at the Spoleto Festival, which led to his being named music director of the Mostly Mozart Festival in New York City. Then in 2012, music director of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra, the 13th maestro to hold that position since the orchestra began back in 1895, the sixth oldest orchestra in the U.S. He and his Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra have recently released their second recording on their Fanfare Cincinnati label of three new concertos for orchestra by three important living composers. The first release on this label was called Hallowed Ground, and he'll explain why. It featured music of Nico Muhly, Pulitzer Prize winner David Lang, and Aaron Copland's Lincoln Portrait, narrated by the late poet laureate Dr. Maya Angelou. And you're listening to a few minutes from that recording. I spoke with Maestro Langres by phone a few months back.
Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. That is what he said. That is what Abraham Lincoln said.
I'm very happy to be here today with Maestro Louis Langres. And I wanted to start, instead of talking about you, which we will, and talking about Cincinnati, I want to talk about this new recording, because there's a new release you have out, which is on the orchestra's label, the Fanfare Cincinnati label. First of all, congratulations on it. We'll talk about it here. A two-disc set. And I wanted to talk about it in three different areas. And the first is, I mentioned, this is another release on the Fanfare Cincinnati label, which has been a trend, I guess, now maybe we'll call it 15 years, maybe it goes back to 20 years, but where orchestras have their own physical record labels, putting out CDs and whatever will happen with CDs and recordings and how that's going to play out in the years to come. What's the importance these days of an orchestra the stature of Cincinnati being able to have their own label and to put out onto the market, as it were, what they want to do?
Freedom that of programming. You know, the market, you know, has completely changed. Nothing which was true even 5 years ago is the same today. And when you speak with a major company, they need to sell many CDs. So first thing would be, what would be sellable?
Right.
And for us, first thing is to say, what do we want to say? How do we want to contribute to the big diffusion of an artistic message? And to do what we want, what we think is essential.
Right.
So the Fanfare label, the name comes because Fanfare for the Common Man, which is one of almost the national anthem, was actually commissioned from the CSO to Aaron Copland. We premiered it, as we premiered also Lincoln Portrait.
Right.
So we wanted even the name of the label to express something very strong to us.
The congratulations on the CD comes on that you have this label, which is great, as many major orchestras do. And I think it is a great trend. Like you said, it gives you the freedom. And then that second point is exactly what you said, is that 15, 20 years ago, there is no way that the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra recording for a major label would have been allowed to put out this recording. There is just no way anyone would have okayed it. This contains, we'll talk about the pieces, but it contains three brand new works by living composers, major works by them. And I really applaud the fact that you did that. But what it shows too, I think, is the commitment you have with the orchestra to do something like this. It seems that way. Is that correct?
Oh, definitely. But I think it's part of my contract. I mean, it's not written,
right,
but of my responsibility, of the contrat moral. I don't know how to translate that. Because from the early years, I mean, the orchestra is one of the oldest in this country, started in 1895, there was this constant feeling that we should play music of our time and we should commission pieces. I think it's not by chance that we have this amazing list of composers who came here in Cincinnati, who conducted the orchestra or played, performed with them. I mean, when you look 100 years ago, Richard Strauss came, Camille Saint-Saëns came, Edgar Varèse came, Edward Elgar came, Respighi, Scriabin played his piano concerto, and Rachmaninoff came many times to play and conduct. Stravinsky conducted in the 20s before he had his statue, you know, when he was a hooligan in classical music. Gershwin came, Bartok played his first piano concerto, and Leonard Bernstein, Penderecki, John Adams. I mean, it's so impressive. And I think because promoting contemporary music was also part of the vision of this orchestra.
Before we get to the third factor of the CD, which are the composers that are on it and the choices you made too. It's interesting what you said, because if you combine the first two, you've said some really interesting things, quotes that I've read about just what you said, how the orchestra's role, the symphony orchestra's role this day in playing music of our time, and how it's so crucial at this point. And it should be the same as if we're back in Mozart's time, when it was all new music back then.
Absolutely. Even if they had no chance in Vienna to have heard a piece done in Paris or in Italy or wherever, they wanted new music. They wanted music composed for them. And we should never forget that Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms only composed contemporary music.
And that's what audiences expected when they went. It changed over the 19th century, but back at the beginning of the 19th century and 18th century. But what's interesting with the recording, I mean, when I've had so many great composers on this program over the 12 years it's been on, they love the commission. I'm talking about a major commission like here, or a major premiere, let's say by the Cincinnati. They love the performance. It's always that second performance or how the piece lives after that, which is the tough nut to crack. And I think with the recording, with orchestras now being able to do what you did on this two CD set, it does in some way enable these pieces to live on, even if you can't program them because of logistics and money and all the rest of the headache of a major organization like this to play it every year. You know what I'm saying is there's a way for this music to live on is to be able to have this on your CD label, correct?
Absolutely. That, yeah, it's great to commission pieces, it's great to premiere them, but then a piece has to live its own life, and as it lives through performances, through concerts. It has to be conducted by me with other orchestra. It has to be performed by other orchestras with other conductors who would have a different perception, different reading of the piece. And it's important another way, of course, to record them. It was already the case with our first CD together, where we recorded the live concert. They are all live concerts of the first time this piece was brought into life.
Right.
Before it was just notes on papers. Well, I think one can feel this excitement, this incandescent feeling of playing it for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
There is no tradition. We just start from, or we make the, we don't make the tradition, but we start. Yeah, for the first CD with the world premiere of David Lang and Nico Muhly, I had calls from directors of orchestras telling me, oh, we want to do this piece.
That's great.
And that's wonderful. That's wonderful. It's not that I don't want to conduct Beethoven or whatever. Of course I do it. And it's essential for the orchestra to do it. And actually, in this country, I owe a lot to Mozart.
Right.
But it makes you probably having a different perception of even classical or romantic music because you conduct them and the musician play them as it were contemporary music. It's not all Brahms symphony, we know it. It's starting again from the score and questioning the piece. What does it mean? Not starting from the general tradition. I think it's exciting that way to conduct repertoire pieces like contemporary music and to make contemporary music part of the history of the music and part of the repertoire.
From the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra's new two-disc set performing three new concertos for orchestra, by content if not by name, here are some minutes from the final movement of the sixth movement work called Flex, all in caps, by a composer you know well due to his years as artist-in-residence at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, Sebastian Currier. This movement is titled Group Dynamics. The Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra is led by their music director and my guest today, Louis Langres.
We'll be right back. The other aspect of this two CD set, which is interesting, is that it could not have been made as any type of recording in the first 50 years of the Cincinnati Symphony's existence, because until Béla Bartók put out a piece, quote-unquote, called a concerto for orchestra and put his stamp on that titling of a piece, all three of these pieces are essentially that. They may not be named that, but they're essentially concertos for orchestra, and that's what the disc is called. I wonder if you could talk about the three very different composers that are on this disc, and our audience is very familiar with one of them because Sebastian Currier was the artist in residence here in Princeton at Einstein's Institute for Advanced Study for the last years, and he co-hosted many concerts with me because Sebastian had to put on concerts at the Institute, and we broadcast all of those. So our audience knows Sebastian very, very well. But talk about the three different composers, how they came together, how you chose them. I mean, this is a really interesting mix of composers here.
Well, yes. And why concertos for orchestra? I think one of the important recordings in the history of CSO's recording was the recording they made with Paavo Järvi with Bartók and Lutoslavski, mm-hmm. concertos for orchestra. This is an amazing recording. And I wanted also to see if we could continue this tradition, I mean, very, very small tradition, because, yes, the major pieces are Bartók and Lutoslavski, which means, unlike a symphony, it's more about instrumentation than orchestration, right. More like in making individual players or individual group of players dialoguing together rather than having just one collective discourse. Another thing is that most of the time, I think now composers need to take inspiration either by a book or by a painting or by a landscape, and it looks a little bit old-fashioned to write a symphony, for instance.
Right.
Pieces have titles. And some beautiful titles. When you look at the Henri Dutilleux, there is already music in the title. So probably the form of a concerto for orchestra is more abstract, but it doesn't mean that it's dry. I mean, of course, if there is music, there is expression by itself. And the concerto for orchestra, the Bartók one, which is, of course, the major piece in the repertoire, is not abstract music. It is full of expression and fear and fun and joy and sarcasm or humor and desperation and et cetera, et cetera. And actually, our composers gave some surtitles or subtitles to their piece.
Right.
So we wanted to make a kind of cycle, and of course the magic number of three is very powerful. So who to choose? We wanted diversity. There were composers I knew. There were composers that the CSO brought my attention to. Sebastian Currier, I had already heard his music, and I love the direct impact it has on you. I mean, it's so visceral. It's so immediate that I wanted to conduct pieces from him. So we have an American composer. We have with Zhou Tian, who is this young, he lives in the U.S., but he comes from China. So one can feel in his musical language the influence of Eastern inspiration, although it's not to oppose the two. I think it's wonderful to see how Zhou Tian actually absorbed all the influences and to make his own language. He was actually the only one of the three who had already composed a piece for the orchestra. He knew the musicians, and he told me that when he was composing the piece, he heard the CSO sound. He heard our principal oboe, flute, etc., and he composed for them, for the musicians.
Yeah, that's great.
It doesn't mean that, of course, it cannot be played by another orchestra, but this was his source of inspiration. And Thierry Esquèche, who comes from Europe, from France. And in France, we have this very strong tradition of organist composers. I mean, it starts from a long time ago. But if we go from the 19th century, there is this very famous organ school, which is called l'orgue symphonique. So the organist had the vision of recreating an orchestra by playing the organ.
Right.
Here is, of course, the opposite way. But Charles Gounod, Gabriel Fauré, César Franck, of course, Camille Saint-Saëns, Olivier Messiaen was the most famous one in the 20th century, and Durufle, etc. There are so many. And Thierry Esquèche has this, one can feel that he's an organist in the texture. I mean, it's not a piece written for organ and then orchestrated. No, it's really a piece for orchestra, but composed by an organist. And the other thing which is very noticeable is now in classical music, the organists are the last one, the last musician to improvise. We don't have any more, Beethoven and Mozart, in their concert, in their recital, they were almost all the time an improvisation. And of course, we know that many, many pianists, not only composers, were improvising the cadenza of the concertos. This doesn't exist anymore, except for the organists who have kept this tradition of improvising. Of course, I'm not speaking about jazz, but just in classical music. And one can feel that in Thierry Esquèche's piece, this kind of immediacy, you know, of the piece has a very rigorous form, but in the expression, suddenly you have this unexpected phrase who comes, like in an improvisation.
Right.
So I think, of course, there is the unity of the same project and of writing a piece from a formal staff, but then each composer, of course, took his inspiration where he wanted. I didn't ask, please write to us a formal piece or an abstract piece. Of course not. Three different languages, three different projects to make this wonderful, identifiable project with three separate pieces, but united in the same vision.
Yeah, no, it's great because I think you're right. By leading the composers towards a quote-unquote concerto for orchestra, you can really fire their imaginations of where they can go with that. Whereas other forms are a little more hemmed in. You know, if it's a concerto, do I write it in three movements? This type of thing, you know. But this can really fire them up. And what's interesting about all three pieces is you can trace, whether they would admit it or not, there is inspiration going all the way back to the Bartok. I mean, Sebastian's piece sort of looks at those inner movements of the Bartok, and the Esquèche piece, the grandeur of the form of the Bartok. It's very fascinating how these three composers turned out these pieces, how you fired their inspiration or their imagination and what they came up with. It's fascinating. So
yes, and I must say, I'm still amazed by the bold imagination of Sebastian Currier. I mean, these 15 versions of the same phrase,
yeah.
To make a movement of that, that's fantastic. The micro variation, echoes, canon, and a minuet.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, I must confess that when I read it, I thought, oh, is it really going to sound? Is it going to work? And actually, it does.
Yeah.
And instant. Fantastic. So, yes, alone and together. That could be a subtitle of the definition of a concerto for orchestra.
Yeah.
It's really that. I think it's absolutely wonderful also to feel their influences. There is definitely jazz inspiration in Sebastian's piece. There is, by itself, just by choosing the three chorales, there is a kind of sacred music feeling in our organ composer Thierry Esquèche, and one definitely can feel the inspiration from Eastern music in Zhou Tian's piece.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's all
I love the fact that it's like a trilogy in film. You can listen to the three of them and you can listen to each of them only. It works. It's exciting.
I applaud the project. It's really very, very cool. And I hope a lot of orchestras pick up the sort of the vibe of what you've done here and can really work on that with their own orchestras and with another set of composers. Again, dipping into this two-disc set by the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra of three contemporary concertos for orchestra, here are the final moments from the third movement leading into the fourth movement of the French composer Thierry Esquèche's Salmos, Symphonia Concertante for Orchestra based on chorale hymn tunes. My guest Louis Langres leads his Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. little bit about you for our audience. You come to music through your family. Your father's an organist, and you actually don't study conducting. You actually sort of get yourself into various opera houses, being a repetiteur and things, and watching what the conductors do, I guess, most famously in Lyon, where you got to see John Elliott Gardner, and then you get your chance. Now, I don't know if this is a path you'd recommend to young students studying conducting, or if they could even do it today, but just a little bit about being able to get up on the podium from having observed and then getting that chance. That's an interesting way for a conductor to learn his craft.
Absolutely, and quite common, I would say, in Germany, where they have a lot of opera houses.
Sure.
You know, when you rehearse a production, you have so many rehearsals, but first just stage rehearsals with a piano. So if an ensemble with singers doesn't work, maybe they didn't pay attention because they were concentrated on the staging, but maybe it might be your fault as well. So you can try various things, and little by little, it helps you to create your own body language, mm-hmm. depending on your morphology, of your character, of your sensitivity. And I would say that there is not one way for conductors. Of course, by taking that way, it probably took more time for me to some aspect of technique because I had no real teacher.
Right.
I mean, of course, I observed, I asked questions to conductors, etc. I was not alone in my room,
right,
and suddenly felt like a conductor. But I would say for conductors who did just the opposite, who studied, who had always help of teachers telling them, this is how you should do, then there is another limitation they have to fight against. And each one has to take the path the way that he feels right. And that actually then that life offers to you. There is never one way. But I think I was so fortunate to have started more as an opera conductor who then was conducting symphonic repertoire. Now I think I'm more of a symphony conductor or concert conductor who enjoy conducting opera. And that has probably to do, yes, with John Elliott Gardiner, who developed my taste, my sensitivity, my pleasure to work with musician playing on period instruments. It's not only the instruments, it's also the musicians who decided to do so. When you start violin or flute, you don't decide to start on the baroque flute.
Right.
It is an individual process to not say, okay, we play like that because my teacher said it or because the tradition is like that. No, it's questioning the piece, and it's such a source of inspiration. And I regularly conduct, I don't know, Mozart, Beethoven, but also Debussy. I conducted Pelléas et Mélisande at the Opéra Comique where it was premiered with an orchestra, same size and same instrument or same type of instruments. And it was an amazing experience. I couldn't imagine that. And it's now down probably in the U.S. It's still specific and like two camps observing each other. I mean, either you play on period instrument or you play on modern instrument.
Right.
When I conducted with the Orchestre des Champs-Élysées, Pelléas et Mélisande, the solo oboe was actually solo oboe with at the Opéra National de Paris. So he most of the time play on modern instruments. The first horn was first horn at the Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France and love experiments with different instruments. And I think it's more how you, it's a bad word, it's a bad expression, how you position yourself.
It, sure.
It sounds a bit dry, but to keep always curious, you know, not to take the tempo of the CD because you like it, but on the contrary, what does this piece mean? Then, therefore, what is the most appropriate tempo to take? I mean, going back to our living composers, the great chance for us with contemporary music is that you can ask the composers, why that? What does it mean? So often I would dream to ask to Debussy, Mozart, or Beethoven, why that? Because, of course, they have their original musical vision, and then they transcribe it on the paper with notes, rhythm, orchestration, but it's only notes. And then as interprets, you have to do the opposite way. We are like archaeologists, starting from the note and then questioning what does it mean. And then I must say that dialoguing, questioning composers is a wonderful experience. And sometimes, actually, they have no answer themselves. You cannot put words on every musical thought, but it helps so much.
Yeah, sometimes it needs to be expressed in the music and not through language.
Absolutely.
Before we get you to Cincinnati, I need you to answer one question between. So you did position yourself well. You had a career going in Europe, France, Belgium, even with the UK. How did that translate to you getting, in 2002, named to head the Mostly Mozart Festival in New York? I mean, take our audience from that linkage, how that happened.
I think Jane Moss wanted a conductor. I mean, when you do Mozart, sorry, that's such a bad expression, when you conduct Mozart's music,
yeah.
There is instrumental music, theatrical music, and sacred music. And then, of course, I don't know, in Mozart's C minor mass, there is so much theater. In Don Giovanni, the last fugue, you can compare it to the last fugue of Jupiter's symphony. And a fugue is actually this kind of perfection of structure that you use in sacred music, because perfection in the form symbolized perfection of the universe, which is God. So you need to have a feeling of all these aspects, and having conducted many Mozart operas, you mentioned Glyndebourne, which was an amazing place for me to go deeper in Mozart's language. And also in Glyndebourne, for instance, I had conducted Don Giovanni, Nozze di Figaro, and Così fan tutte with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, but Idomeneo with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. So composers compose for the instrument they know, and in the same time are opening the doors to the future. It shouldn't be only performed by modern orchestra or by period orchestras, but having the double visions can only enrich your inspiration. So she needed somebody who conducts orchestras, or at least to have a taste for that, a pleasure for that, period orchestras, and also who conduct modern orchestra, who loves the feeling of theatrical dramaturgy in a just instrumental piece. And I had conducted several times as a guest the orchestra. We had a wonderful relationship, so why not go further and deeper? And I must say, it's a blessing for me to work there.
It must have been a great feeling to get to be named the position, you know, taking over for Jerry Schwartz after all those years, and then just being placed right in Manhattan, you know, at Lincoln Center with the Mostly Mozart Festival.
And we did. I'm very proud, because we commissioned and we premiered also new pieces. That was 10 years ago for the Magnus Lindberg Violin Concerto that we did with Lisa Batyashvili. And then she recorded it, and now more and more violinists play it with different orchestras. And so it's wonderful to feel that you have been adding a piece to the repertoire. And this piece has its own life now.
Yeah, you're even adding to the repertoire through the Mostly Mozart Festival.
Yes.
Cincinnati. Cincinnati is the sixth oldest orchestra in the U.S., and everybody talks about the Big Five. Well, Cincinnati's right there on their tail. Very important orchestra. You mentioned before some of the premiers and the conductors and composers who've stood in front of this orchestra. Then you were named the 13th music director of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. Now, as is usually the case, you had conducted the group before, and then you got to know each other, and then when they were looking for someone to replace Pavlyarvi, you know, it's you. But, you know, as doesn't always happen, something must have clicked, because you're now renewed through 2020. Something's happening in Cincinnati, which is good. And I'm wondering if you can put it into words. What clicked between you and the orchestra, the city, the administration? It's a good thing going on there, is it not?
Oh, it's a wonderful chapter of my life. I had no orchestra. I was not music director, apart from Mostly Mozart, for several years, because I needed, after many, many years, to have some freedom. But more and more, I felt that, yes, you can have wonderful experiences in, I don't know, in Tokyo, in Melbourne, Berlin. But either you have the feeling to embrace the world by going to all these places, or by just doing the opposite, which is concentrating on one place, and then in that way embracing the world in a different way. So music director is not conducting more often than the guest conductors. The place of art, of music in this city is absolutely essential. I moved with my family from Paris to Cincinnati. Our children are at high school now here in Cincinnati, because it's not only as a musician, you need to be there as a man. You need to understand, not by people telling you, but deeply, the grandeur, the richness, the beauty, and also the problems of the city. And then an orchestra is here to be part of the healing of this problem, of the solutions of this problem. So first in Cincinnati, he has a German immigration history. The CSO is an American orchestra, but with German DNA, I would say. And I come from France, from Alsace, which is a French region with some German DNA. And actually, where Music Hall is located in Cincinnati is called Over the Rhine. And Alsace is over the Rhine. So I felt at home. I feel at home. But I feel especially at home musically. The first time I came was to conduct a Brahms program, Brahms and Schumann. And quite often, it's a bit stereotyped, so sorry about that. But yeah. American orchestra compared to European orchestra has these clear attacks, you know, crystal clear, quite vertical, like the architecture, like so many skyscrapers.
Right.
And in Cincinnati, I was very impressed because immediately they had this, of course, vertical feeling of ensemble and of crystal clear attacks, but also of the shape. So it was not only vertical, it was also horizontal. And the density of the sound is something very noticeable here. And I really love that. Another aspect, so as a music director, is the connection between the orchestra and the community. I mean, I didn't know what community meant. Actually, in French, communauté doesn't mean the same thing. It comes also from the beginning of this orchestra. Many of American orchestras are built on the same conception as European orchestras. In Europe, you had kings and or dukes, princes who had their own, made their own, created their orchestra and generously offered music to people,
public, yeah.
Music lovers. Here in the U.S., the kings and the prince are these important industrial people. But in Cincinnati, it was different because in order not to be homesick, people started this big choral society, still living now at the May Festival chorus. They sang Messiah, Elijah, etc. And at a certain point, they felt that it would be much more enjoyable to sing with a real orchestra instead of four-hand piano reduction or organ or harmonium. So the feeling of the necessity, of the need of having their own orchestra was a shared feeling. It was not somebody decided generously to create an orchestra. It was this shared feeling. And I think one can still feel that. People are proud of their orchestra. Even people who don't like especially classical music, they know that their orchestra is important. It's part of the city. It's not a plus, you know. It's not, we have, in addition of all the great thing, we have culture. No, it's not in addition. It's part of the city. That's why when my first concert, after having been named music director, where this luminosity experience that we had in Washington Park, right in front of the building, we had in 3 days 45,000 people.
Wow.
Can you imagine that? So they didn't know what to expect. They just knew that there was going to be something special, extraordinary, made for them. And it was with this lightning on the walls. But 45,000, that's amazing.
That was the one city, one symphony thing you did. There are symphony orchestras who couldn't draw even close to that over the entire subscription season that they
yes,
present.
Absolutely. And yes, one city, one symphony. I'm so proud. I mean, it's not my idea. It's Trey Davies, our president's ideas. But it's so wonderful to go deeper in a piece and then using the music and the musical message to go deeper into your own sensitivity and sensibility. And that's something wonderful. It's not to say, oh, I love this concert, I love this piece, but I didn't like the other one. No, it's how do I open my heart, my brain, my secret garden, and of course, discovering or rediscovering these pieces, but more important, using these pieces to rediscover your own sensitivity and sensibility. And then the role of an orchestra is essential.
My guest, Maestro Louis Langres, leads the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, accompanying soprano Nathalie Dessay in the famous Queen of the Night aria, Der Hohle Rache, from Mozart's Magic Flute.
Last thing here, then we'll wrap, because I think Cincinnati, and many cities have this, but Cincinnati, I think, is the only other city you can think of is Boston, where, in addition to the symphony orchestra, there's a pops orchestra that is extremely well known and extremely well recorded. Of course, much of that through the work of Maestro Eric Kunzel, who's no longer with us, and now John Morris Russell. I'm just wondering, for you, you just described how the symphony orchestra is such part of the cultural fabric of Cincinnati. They're really proud of it. But you also have this very well-known pops orchestra. There has to be a benefit there, right, for both groups to be able to have that much support?
Yes, but I would say that it's also artistic. I remember one of my first programs. So I went to a pops concert just before conducting my rehearsals. It was with American music and also music by James Bond. And I was amazed by the sound. I mean, in Europe, we don't have pop concerts.
Right.
It's not the same way. So the day after, I was rehearsing Olivier Messiaen, Les Offrandes Oubliées, The Forgotten Offering.
Right.
So the first part is very mystic and about suffering. And the second part is like Le Sacre du Printemps, or the Rite of Spring, you know, this music of destruction and hooligans, and it needs sharp attacks, clear rhythm. And they played it in a very civilized way and said, no, please, I want the pops sound, you know, direct, clear attack, almost metallic in the brass to express that. And they were a bit shocked. They said, well, do you really want us to play with a pops sound? This music, and of course it's not this music, it was this part, but it's the same in some parts of what, Symphonie Fantastique, especially the two last movements. So it only adds to the palette of sounds and colors, and I love that. I really love that, and if it gives also, you know, access to classical music for people who goes in the pops concert because it's less intimidating, but they feel that maybe going to a classical concert, there is a, I don't know, social aspect or whatever. No, music is for everybody. And it shouldn't be people going to the pubs and people going to the concerts. They can enjoy both sides of it. And actually, an American in Paris, Gershwin, is it pops or classical?
Yeah.
It's hard to know. I conducted last month with Branford Marsalis, Escapades from John Williams. Is it pops or is it classic? It's both. Is a Rossini overture pops or classic? Again, there is no clear wall between the two genres. There is good music or not good, so let's play the good one.
I was just thinking of that scenario, which may just really sum up why you and Cincinnati are working so well together, that of a French-born conductor telling an American orchestra they have to play 20th century French music more like their pops music. And that sort of sums it up right there. You know, that's a really funny story. I'm glad that you're there through 2020. I am looking forward, since those of us who don't live in Cincinnati and can't come to the concerts and enjoy what you're doing with the Symphony Orchestra Live, we can do it through the label, which we started this discussion at, because I look forward to the next release on Fanfare Cincinnati, because I think you're doing really great work there, because the first two releases are fascinating.
Thank you so much. Yes, I am proud of what we are doing.
Yeah, it's really great stuff. So about 3.5 more years at least in Cincinnati, so a lot of good stuff coming from there. I wish you the best of success with them. I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two quick questions. And the first question is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat like we've been chatting here with someone from the past, someone who you never had a chance to, what's the first name that pops into your head of somebody you'd love to talk with?
You mean a composer?
Doesn't matter. I've had everything from God to Groucho Marx, but usually it's a composer, yeah. When I asked that question, I just wondered what the first name was of somebody you just loved to talk to but never could.
I would say Franz Liszt.
Liszt? That's interesting for a conductor.
But, you know, for all the composers in the 19th century, there was this weight on their shoulders. How can we compose another symphony after Beethoven 9? And also, what should we compose as a sonata after especially the three last piano sonatas?
Mm-hmm.
And I think Liszt is the one who invented the new world for that. And he was so influential on Wagner, of course, and on the other side, Berlioz. I mean, two composers who didn't like each other. And he was friends with Chopin. When I said Liszt, it's because then you have the Chopin, Schumann, Mendelssohn, Saint-Saëns, and maybe the other as a conductor, Mahler.
Yeah.
But also because Mahler embraced the opera. He never composed an opera, but he was the greatest opera conductor of his time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the most influential. So Tchaikovsky spoke so highly of him. So by meeting Mahler, you meet, in a way, Tchaikovsky, etc. And
that's interesting.
As a composer also, definitely Mahler third.
Yeah.
Mahler first or Mahler second, you can still feel the shadow of Beethoven. But Mahler third, ending his symphony with this adagio, that's another world. Of course, probably, if Tchaikovsky wouldn't have composed his sixth symphony, maybe he wouldn't have dared to compose it that way. But then we have, his ninth symphony, he was just such a major conductor and a composer with such an amazing vision and courage. He must have been fascinating. When you read what Bruno Walter says about him, I even had the great privilege, probably I didn't realize how great this privilege was, to meet Max Deutsch, who was this very 12th tone theoretician, but who told me the death of Mahler when he was his student colleagues outside the door, and it was amazing.
Wow.
So, these composers are close to us in time and, of course, in importance and musical message.
The runaway answer to that question is Bach. But among conductors over the years, it is Mahler. So the list / Mahler is fascinating. The final question is a non-musical question, meaning everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You are extremely busy. But when you have to step away, when you have to get a little respite, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do you do that can take you away from music for a few moments when you need to do that?
I walk in the countryside, in the mountain, in the forest, alone.
Ah.
my job is, in a way, always in the middle of many people as a conductor.
Right.
But it's also a very solitaire life. I mean, you're alone in front of the score, in front of the orchestra. I need to listen to the silence or to the music of, I don't know, birds or the wind in the tree to never get disconnected from the world I like. And of course, many orchestras are in cities, cannot have a major orchestra in a village. My parents live actually in a little village in Alsace, and this is such a source of reconnection and rejuvenation. I don't know how to say it.
Rejuvenation.
I need the feeling with nature, the connection with nature. And I'm lucky because Cincinnati also, is having this German heritage where the nature is much more included in German city or in Anglo-Saxon cities,
right,
compared to Latin.
Right.
In Latin cities, the nature is domesticated. You have the jardin à la française or Italian gardens where the beauty, the strength, and it's amazing, yes, but it's how the human thinking, thought, and talent is here to domesticate the nature, to dominate the nature, to have these amazing shapes of trees, of et cetera, while in Germany or English garden, illusion that you create the nature as it is without man's hand.
Well, you've found places around Cincinnati, whether on the Ohio side or cross over into the Kentucky side. You know, there's some beautiful places around there, especially along the river. So, you know.
Absolutely. There are beautiful places. And sometimes we, alone or with my family, we discover the beauties of Ohio or Kentucky around Cincinnati. And we live in East Walnut Hills, which is a place where, I mean, we have a garden, we have trees. We make our own vegetable garden. It's important as a musician and as a man.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you taking some time. I wish you the best of success in your own career, but also with Cincinnati in the years you have left there. You're doing some great things there. So, as they say, keep it going. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you. And, you spoke a lot about 2020 and maybe more.
Yes. Hopefully. Yeah.
But for now, I'm deeply happy here.
Well, great, and you're doing great stuff there. So, I mean, it is heartening to see when a music director and an orchestra are doing things that really have an impact, and I think that's what's happening there. So, keep up the good work, I guess.
Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
Maestro Louis Langres, music director of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. Find out more about what he's doing in Cincinnati and about their recordings on the Fanfare Cincinnati label at cincinnatisymphony.org. May is Maestro Month here on Cadenza, and next week we'll visit with the music director of the Minnesota Orchestra, the Finnish conductor Osmo Venska. But back to Cincinnati, I'll leave you with one more track from that two-disc set of three new concertos for orchestra, a very enterprising endeavor, on the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra's own label, Fanfare Cincinnati. This from the Chinese-American composer Zhou Tian. This, the only work on the two-disc set actually titled Concerto for Orchestra. We'll hear the third movement from the four-movement work, this titled Seeker's Scherzo. You can hear more music of Zhou Tian as the Princeton Symphony Orchestra performs the U.S. premiere of his Broken Ink at 4 p.m. at Richardson Auditorium on the campus of Princeton University this Sunday. PrincetonSymphony.org for tickets and information. Here then, Seeker's Scherzo, the third movement from Concerto for Orchestra by Zhou Tian, the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra, led by their music director and my guest today, Louis Langres. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org, clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.